Okay. Welcome back to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. I'm Paul Redneck. I'm your host. And I want to welcome Alan Dally to the Bozo Zone today. Or the Zen Zone, however you like to look at it. Thanks, Alan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Alan, gosh, I was thinking this the other day, how long you and I have been friends. It seems like it's been five, six. Every time I think about it, I realize I'm missing a couple years out of it, because I think about, you know, when we got to know each other, when our kids being in the School of Rock, I was thinking how old I have to go back to how old my kids were right. When they started to when you and I got to know each other. And I think it's been 6 years, maybe.
I would say it's been at least 6 years.
Okay, maybe longer.
Right.
Maybe longer. But it's we've gotten to know each other and talked a lot and have a lot of similar interests in life about a number of different things. But one of the things that we do start out the show with, and if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about your history, you know, kind of how you got here and some of what your background was like and where you grew up. And I believe you grew up in Utah and Salt Lake. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah. I was born in Salt Lake City a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far, far away.
Good job.
Back in 1958. And I was the second child out of five kids.
We're only 2 years apart, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
2 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We're getting up there.
Yeah.
My father was in the service, and so we traveled quite a bit. So I was born in Salt Lake. Immediately, we went to San Francisco. He'd taken a break from the Air Force and started a shoe company there on Market Street.
In San Francisco.
In San Francisco. Okay. And then my little brother was born about a year and a half after I was born. So there was three boys all born within 3 years. And needless to say, that was quite taxing on my mother.
I can only imagine.
Well,
was the dynamic at home with dad working and mom at home? Was she the primary caregiver at home?
Yeah, he had started a business. It was the third Red Wing shoe store in the country that he had opened up.
Oh,
so
really? Oh,
okay. There was nobody knew the brand. Nobody knew what Red Wing shoes were. So there weren't like people beating the doors down to buy the product. And it was an extremely difficult, strenuous time for them. He had put his life savings into this shoe company, and it was, you know, 6 days a week, pack your lunch from home, take it to work. Mm-hmm. He was the only one working in the store. Nobody else was there to help him.
So he opened up a business, his store, the Red Wing Shoe Store. There's a little bit of my childhood lisp coming out.
Yep.
And he was the only employee, too, at the time. So,
right.
And this was a retail front type store, right?
Yeah, this was a retail front type store. So my mother had three little boys. Obviously, you know, there were no disposable diapers back in those days.
That's true. I didn't think of that.
Two flights of stairs. And I mean, needless to say, it was very, very humble beginnings for them. My father was born and raised in southern Idaho on a farm, so he knew what work was. He knew what a work ethic was all about.
So was it 6 days a week because of the religious faith that they didn't work on Sundays, or was it another reason, another choice?
At that point, most stores were not open on Sundays.
You're right. I grew up in Connecticut in the same type of thing. They call it a blue law state, and Sundays most things shut down.
Right, right.
Yeah.
This was before the era of big retailers, before the era of shopping malls. Shopping malls really didn't exist back then. So it was, I think, for the vast majority of society, it was, you know, stores were open from Monday through Saturday and closed on Sundays.
Yeah.
And there were few exceptions to that.
You know, it's I realize as we're talking about this, that this is me and the way I'm thinking about, you know, reflecting on the world and saying something as simple as things were closed on Sundays. That was generally across the board. I mean,
yes.
I mean, I think in Utah, because you used to be able to buy cars on Sunday in Utah until, you know, there was a slight change through the legislature,
right.
pushed in by Mr. Miller himself at some point. But that was actually the norm. I mean, stores were closed on Sundays.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
True. Yeah. So my father got called back into the Air Force in 1963 because of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, my.
And so they wanted experienced pilots back in the Air Force, and mm-hmm. so they called him, and he went back in, and then he got sent to Vietnam in 1965.
Oh.
And at that point, we were living in Florida. So we moved back to Idaho with my grandmother, my mother's mother, so that she could help with the kids and that. And then at that point, we'd had another child. My younger sister, Jan, was born, and so then my father came back from Vietnam. We moved to California, where he was training pilots that were going over to Southeast Asia to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in California at George Air Force Base. We stayed there for about a year, and then he got out of the service and went into the reserve, and we moved to Salt Lake City, and that was when I was about 9 years old.
How old was your dad, do you think, about that time, Dee?
My father was an old man when he went to Vietnam. He was in his early 30s. So he was probably around 37 years of age when he went back to Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And then...
what happened to the store, actually?
He had hired... In the meantime, he'd hired another gentleman to come in and run the store while he was in the service.
In the service, okay.
And so... He had that store.
And that worked out.
And that worked out, yeah.
Wow.
It was doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
Business had been growing steadily for several years. So then he came back to Salt Lake and was going to get into the car business with his brother, Klein.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't turn out. And so he started a clothing business. And mm-hmm. that was in 1968. And it was called Dally's Big and Tall. And
for those that are listening that grew up in Salt Lake City, I think just about everybody would know what and who Dally's Big and Tall is, right?
Yeah. So
and so was the original store down there in the Keith Building? I can't remember, to be honest.
It was on 242 South Main.
Yeah.
So that's where things got started. And then, of course... as one of the young sons, I got the opportunity to go and work with my father down at the business and in the store, and that's where I started my early training as far as
business
and work and all that fun stuff. And it was a real. It was a really great time to be a young person in America.
Sure.
You had the...
we're talking the late 60s, early 70s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The 60s. Being raised in the 60s and 70s was quite a interesting time for mm-hmm. America. I mean, it was... you could say it was the height of the... the best, you know, the greatest generation was in full swing.
Sure.
Post-war,
too. I mean, we're almost a generation out
right.
of the war. I'm talking about the World War II, of course. But your dad had been in Vietnam as well, so he had been active for a long time. Yeah.
Yes, and so... we got to grow up and watch the rocket launches to the moon, and we got to see... You know, the United States put a man on the moon was a pretty amazing thing to experience as a young person.
Yes, exactly. I remember exactly where I was. Do you, I mean, I'm sure you do too, right? That watching that on a black, I was on a, watching it on a black and white TV. Yeah. Or maybe it wasn't color, but the truth is that the broadcast was black and white, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, so right. Like, and not a very clear picture.
And not a very,
very fuzzy.
It took a few minutes to get here or something like that. But I can remember I was living with my mom in Essex, Connecticut, and she had rented this house, and it was like it was right on the point that stuck out into the Connecticut River. So the house, I mean, first of all, it didn't have a basement because it was, you know, anytime the river would flood, but it was on stilts. I mean, this house was on stilts. I mean, you wouldn't know it looking at it. It didn't really quite look like it was, but it was lifted up off the ground because if any of the floodwaters came in, it was only 3 or 4 feet, you know, above the river. So, I mean, what the high state of the river would be. So,
So anyway, so it was, you know, that my father was in the military and then, you know, here we had put a man on the moon. You know, obviously there was the Cold War going on, but, you know, I always felt a sense of optimism about my future, what anything that you wanted to be, more or less, you could be. Didn't see these big hurdles or barriers other than the ones that you constructed yourself, more or less.
So your own, the ones that you put in front of yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so you had a sense of accountability at a pretty young age, is what it sounds like, Alan.
Yeah. I mean, you know, being raised in a military family and, you know, you knew what the lines that you could cross and that you couldn't cross were. Nobody had to sit and really, you know, sit down with you and explain it. You really kind of had an intuitive understanding of what was right, what wasn't right. My father was a very, very strong role model. He was very well respected. He was an extremely competent leader. And he had very good financial acumen to boot. So I was a beneficiary of all that, being one of his children.
Yeah.
And growing up with that and then, you know, learning work ethic and leadership skills from him, not by listening or talking, but just by watching doing.
It sounds like a great mentorship, actually. So I want to ask you, because you brought up a little while ago this paper you had written, and you'd given it to your father, and then you said 6 months later he opened up this store. Was there a correlation with the paper and these warehouses, the stores that you opened up?
Well,
because I'm just wondering if there was an idea in there, I mean, that you had about this already.
I don't think there was ever a... well, nobody ever really came to me and said, hey, you know what? That was a really good idea. I think we ought to try that. It was more of a, you know, I'm going to open up a large and tall factory outlet store and you know, that's what I'm going to do. Now, prior to that, there had not been any.
There hadn't been any.
Yeah, okay. There really had not been any discussions of even considering something like that. Yeah. So, you know, I like to think that maybe I planted the seed there, but, you know, it really doesn't matter.
No, I gotcha.
But it ended up being a very, very good niche because at that point there were no discount stores for big and tall, and that was always one of the big problems that people complained about was the prices that they had to pay for their clothes because, you know, they were bigger and, you know, well, you know, it takes more material to make a 4X shirt than it does a medium shirt.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, but people still doesn't matter. People still, you know, want the least expensive option they can find. So that market was very, very ripe for that time. And we went out and we were open probably four or five stores a year for probably 5 years.
My goodness.
And we got that business up to, about 20-something stores in just the discount stores. And I remember we were in a manager's meeting, and I was the president of the company. And I got up and I told everybody, you know, we were doing, I think, about $1.5 to $2 million a year in business. And I said, in 3 years, we'll be doing over $10 million in business in this company.
Mm-hmm.
And they all looked at me like I was nuts. And this is a true story. And this illustrates the power of a goal.
Yeah.
Just believing in an idea or a goal.
Yeah. And I want to emphasize how important that is too, because this notion that our beliefs don't hold power, and having a clear goal and a clear intention and a plan to get there, how important that is. And belief systems really do create the life we live. And you and I have talked about this before, but this idea that we are what we believe, and the life we live is the one that we believe it is. So with that, just go ahead and share it out.
So 3 years later, we're at the manager's meeting, and this is no lie. That year, we did $9,976,000 in business.
Isn't that fascinating?
So it just shows you how powerful an idea is.
Yes.
And nothing happens without an idea.
Yeah, it's a starting
point. It's a starting point.
Yeah.
So we got to that point, and in 1993, a company came in and they bought out 28 of our stores.
Wow.
And left us with a bunch of the stores that they didn't want, and they wanted just our men's only stores. They didn't want any of the women's business. They didn't want any of the shoe business. So
right.
We had to keep the women's and the shoes, and then the mediocre men's stores that they didn't want. So,
yeah.
And then at that point, my older brother Mike decided that he wanted to pursue other interests, so he decided to leave the business. So then it was just me and my brother Rob that were running the company after that, and that was in 1993. We decided to make an investment in a manufacturing business after that, 1994. And I just knew that business was going to fail even before I put the money in it.
You did.
Yeah, I did. I told my brother.
Was it a gut feeling? Because
yeah, it was.
We just talked about the power of intention and power of belief and setting goals. But you didn't. I'm curious why. What did you not say that to him at the time? Or
I said it to him when we were walking across the street to sign the documents to close on it.
Okay.
I said, we're going to lose every dime we're putting into this company.
Oh my. Okay.
And we did. We lost every dime. But in the process, at that point, he took the company. Rob, who was a much better leader than I was. I mean, he was from the military. He had the military background. Rob's very highly intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
He's the mayor of Holiday now. I think that probably speaks for itself. And here I am.
Well, I don't want to correlate intelligence with politics, but I do. We'll affirm what that is true, that your brother is a very smart young man.
Yes, he is. He's very, very bright, articulate, and exceptional leader.
Yes.
An exceptional leader.
Yeah.
And so he was running the business.
He didn't pay you anything for that, right?
No, he didn't.
No, he's a great guy.
So he was running the business at that point. And I went over and I got involved in the manufacturing business that was slowly just falling apart. And in that process, I learned how to, you know, make clothes. Hmm. There's a big difference between buying something and selling it, and then there's
the manufacturing.
The manufacturing part of it. Yeah. And so I learned that by doing it, because the people that were over there weren't doing it. And, you know, sometimes it was difficult because I'd be, you know, money was non-existent. It was tight. So I'd be just trying not to spend anything. And here I had sold a company a year and a half before, and I had, you know, a pretty good chunk of change sitting there. So there was this, you know, kind of a dichotomy of what the hell am I doing? You know, I'm sleeping in a Motel 6, you know, in LA, going to sweatshops, you know, trying to figure out how to get stuff made, you know, driving around in little beat up rental cars in East LA.
Oh my.
On Vernon Street and Figueroa and all those places by downtown LA. And so I learned the manufacturing business, and then we closed that company down, and I figured, you know what, I know how to do this, and maybe we ought to start looking to manufacture some of our own stuff. And that was an idea that was not very well received by my brother. He did not want to do that. Mm-hmm. And probably for good reasons. I mean, it was, you know, it was insignificant as far as the overall scheme of things goes. And, you know, he just didn't really feel that there was going to be a decent financial benefit to doing it.
Okay.
And we were having some issues with a couple of our clothing programs, and I said, well, you know what, let's do this shirt, let's do this shirt. You know, the ones that we're buying now are poor quality, and we're paying, you know, we can't get them, we, you know, having difficult time sourcing them and so forth. So we did that. We started importing, and I started going overseas back in the late 90s. I started traveling to Thailand, eventually went to Vietnam and Indonesia, and imported men's clothes and women's clothes. I took my women's buyer with me, and so we started developing programs for our own stores, and then we were also selling to a few other stores out there to help us with getting minimum quantities, because when you import, you have to have a minimum quantity in order to have things made.
Sure.
Depending on what the item is.
Of course. Yeah. Well, if you're going to be able to sell it at a reasonable price, and, you know, you already have a kind of a market that you've gotten, you know, accustomed to, or accustomed to your products, I suppose, too. So you've got to figure out a way to do that that's, you know, cost effective for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So to make a long story short, that business became very, very important for us. It became a critical component to our company. Our private label programs became, you know, a lot of the reason why people would come and shop with us. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about that was they could only buy it through our stores.
Yeah.
They couldn't buy it at our competitors.
Sure.
And that was one of the main reasons to do it, was to give ourselves a competitive advantage. So, and then in 2008, we got a phone call in May, early May, from a company, a big company that wanted to buy the rest of our men's stores. And business was, you know, the internet had come along.
Things were changing.
Things were changing.
Pretty quickly at that point.
Very, yeah, very quickly. Yeah. And we looked down the road, and it was very difficult to see, you know, the market getting much better or any better than where it was. In fact, it looked to us like the market was going to just continuing a slow, steady degradation until, you know, somebody fell out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is JCPenney's going to fall out? Probably not. Is Dillard's going to fall out? Probably not. Is Walmart going to fall out? No. I mean, you just go down the list. It's like, so who's probably going to fall out? Well, it's probably going to be the small, independent, mom-and-pop retailer,
sure,
which is what we were.
Yeah.
So we got an offer, and it was a reasonable offer, and at that point, we decided we were going to sell the company, and so that's what we did. We sold the business, and then I retired, and...
Retired.
I retired. And before that, I had...
From that business, you retired.
So, I mean, that's my professional, mm-hmm, kind of my life story, mm-hmm, professionally.
Sure.
My personal life story is, you know, same thing. I grew up in from a military family.
Yeah.
You know, went to school, got decent grades. I wasn't the smartest person in the world. Wasn't the dumbest person either.
Right. Are you basing that on grades, Alan?
I'm basing that on fact.
Okay.
And I worked, I actually, by when I turned 16, I had, you know, my father didn't pay as well as what I thought I should get paid. So I decided to go out and earn some real money. And I went to work for McDonald's for $2.20 an hour, and worked there for a year. Got fired because I forgot to turn the arches on at night, and went back to work for my dad. So went to the University of Utah, studied finance, got out of school there back in 1983. Worked a lot, met my first wife, Michelle. I was in my early 30s when I met her, got married, had two wonderful boys, Matt and Connor.
Well, we just had lunch with one of them, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then that marriage ended up not working out after 10 years. And then I became single again. Dated a little bit. I waited for quite a while to date, and then I dated a little bit.
What's quite a while?
About a year, a little over a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I met my wife, Wendy, online, and we hit it off, and I really am glad I met her. We got married almost 10 years ago, in 2008. Wow. So, and we had dated 4 years before we got married, so we knew each other, wow, really well.
Yeah.
And it's been a
blended, you know, family too.
Blended family, yeah, which has its challenges, yeah, as anyone who has a blended family knows. Mm-hmm. But I think overall, it's for me, it's been a wonderful experience. It's allowed me to grow as a person,
yeah,
a lot. And I love my stepchildren and my grandchildren, and got 4 grandkids, and so far everything's good.
Yeah.
So
a good life.
Yeah, it's been a really good life.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a couple things I want to talk a little bit about, and we obviously we've talked a lot about a number of different issues, whether it be politics or religion or culture or philosophy, and a couple things I'd like to touch upon and get your thoughts about, even though some of them I may already know the answers to a few of them. This idea of free will and free choice that we as human beings, behaviors kind of believe in such a way that they can pretty much predict how people are going to be. And I'm not saying there's not truth to that at any means. This idea of what it means to have free will. And one of the things, especially within the culture, if we talk culturally, growing up in Salt Lake, there's a predominance of Mormon culture, LDS culture. And they believe in the, and at least from what I've interpreted after living there for 40 years, is this idea of free agency. So there is a sense of free choice, of free will at some level, that we all have that ability to choose what we want to do with our lives and how we're going to act and our behaviors. And you know this through the book that I wrote, that I really believe that we are accountable, that even though there may be some components to this that are predictable, we can kind of understand human behavior and see that there are certain trajectories that it can go in life and kind of predict what that may look like. When it does come down to it, do you believe that there is such a thing as free will, that we have the choice to make changes? I mean, a mutual friend of ours on the podcast a month or so ago, David Fresconi, said, you know, he looks at it kind of from a physics point of view, and that, you know, then physics is pretty predictable, you know, that there is a certain level or amount of predictability when it comes to this. So he takes sort of a scientific approach. What's your take on this, Alan?
Boy, that's a tough question.
There you go.
It's hard to refute David Frasconi. Yeah. I mean, he's a pretty sharp guy, and I respect his intelligence a lot. You know, I studied a little bit in college. You know, you learn about B.F. Skinner, and you learn about conditioning and all those things.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that the environment and that you're raised in or that you're born in mm-hmm. or that you're surrounded by has a tremendous influence on you, especially early in your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're being raised by parents or you're being raised by, you know, grandparents or somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think to think that those things don't affect you, I would have to say I believe that they have an effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
And but I also think that when you get to a certain point in your life that you have the ability to reason and you have the ability to think and you have the ability to make your own choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that.
You do believe in the sense of free will, that we do have the choice.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we have the choice. Now, for some people, that choice is for me, it was honestly relatively easy because I came from a family that, you know, my parents were Mormon and mm-hmm. I went to church when I was a kid, and then when I got to a certain point, then it was my choice whether I wanted to go to church or not.
About how old were you when you...
About 11 or 12.
Okay. So early adolescence, you made a choice that you had decided that you didn't want to follow that tradition.
I just didn't feel connected to that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my older brother... Mm-hmm. certainly felt connected to that.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose to stay on that path, and he is a Mormon bishop, and
uh-huh.
I love him and I respect him. And,
yes.
and
yeah.
you know, that's the path that he chose to make him happy.
Yeah. You know, that you and I were talking about this actually on the way back from lunch today about this idea of respect a little bit when we were coming in the house, and I was about how important that is. We were talking about culturally some, you know, how certain people hold that. And what I just heard you say was probably, I think, one of the most powerful things there is, because which I think also in some ways validates choice, is when it comes to something like respect. Do we have the ability to respect someone and learn about them and become and be able to understand them, so we don't fall into, you know, having biases or prejudice about people. And that idea of respect can, I think, really is a definitive maybe marker of that we do have choice in how we go through life and how whether we're willing to be open and listen and understand and connect with people, or whether we approach it with bias or some kind of discrimination, you know, predetermined confirmation bias, if you will. Yeah,
I mean, my feeling is that in order to respect somebody, you have to understand the concept of tolerance.
Yeah, tolerance. That's because, a perfect word. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's difficult. If you're an intolerant person and you feel that your beliefs and or your ideas, whether they're political or religious, are superior to others,
mm-hmm.
It's very difficult for you to respect others' opinions that differ from yours. And so my feeling is that people that have compassion, people that have tolerance, mm-hmm. people that demonstrate kindness, mm-hmm. Openness,
empathy,
yeah. Those types of things. Yes, I would say that those people have the ability mm-hmm. to respect other people's ideas, opinions that are different from theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it is difficult when you're conditioned to think and act and mm-hmm. believe a certain way your whole life. You may think you're tolerant, or you may think that you're open, but the reality of it is that that's probably a very difficult thing to actually do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm curious with the way that you just sort of explained all that, and especially when you made that choice to not follow, you know, the go to church anymore, or follow necessarily that doctrine. How did mom and dad feel about that? Were they tolerant and loving and supportive of that? I mean, the way you talk about it, it sounds like, because one of the things that I mean, hear these stories over and over again, you know, that often parents struggle with identifying themselves separate from their children. They don't know how to differentiate. And what I just heard you explain, and I want to make sure I'm interpreting it correctly, is that your dad differentiated for himself. He was able to do that and not take personally your choice to do something different than his belief system. Is that what I'm hearing?
Or? Yeah. Now remember, my father was not active at that point.
Okay.
he had been active in the church mm-hmm. Very active in the church. And, but that's why I feel so fortunate, is because I have two parents who love me and respect me, for the most part, regardless of the choices that I make in my life. And that is empowering your children.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's a very difficult thing to do, and I don't see that happen a lot, especially in Utah. You don't see that happen
a lot. That sense of empowerment, individuation, you know. And I know this kind of gets overplayed sometimes, but and always looking for a scapegoat outside of the family system that causes the problem in the first place. But being able to empower our children in such a way to allow them to you know, especially from the aspect of having, I guess, free agency, to being able to figure out this for themselves, to be able to, through their own experience, come to make a decision for themselves and find their truth in this, their true north, so to speak, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, there are no two people on the earth and that have ever been on the earth that are the same.
That's true. Even if though we all come from the same species and our DNA is so close,
right.
There is something different about us, yes.
All of us.
Like snowflakes, right?
Right. There's something different about all of us. And so for me to say, you know, well, this is the right thing to do for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody should think the way I think, or everyone should believe the way I believe, mm-hmm. or everybody should act the way I act, it's not realistic, you know, that works for me.
Right.
It may not work for you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's interesting because I read a little bit about Albert Einstein. You know, his parents took him out when he was 5 years old. They took him into the city and dropped him off and made him find his way back home when he was 5 years old.
I've heard of some version of this before, but I don't remember it. So.
And when I read that, I thought, you know, can you imagine a parent doing that? Today that would probably never ever happen.
Yeah, well, the parents would probably be in jail, right?
Although one lady took
a trip to Germany and, you know, left her kids at home with cereal or something, you know, for a week, right?
But just that idea of allowing your child to become what they are ultimately destined to become, mm-hmm. with a minimal... Let's be honest here, with a minimal amount of guidance per se from an adult.
Right.
I mean, you know, I do think that a parent has an obligation to, you know, perform certain fundamental functions and create certain atmosphere for their children to thrive in, if you want to call it mm-hmm. that. I mean... but certainly when our children get older, I mean, it's, you know, what they do may not, we may not like it, or we may not, want them to do certain things, but ultimately they end up having to live their life and they have to live by their choices. And
exactly.
That's how they become who they are and what they're going to be.
Yeah. I think when I, you know, even this full circle, this is going to be like full circle, it sounds like, in my own head right now. This idea of free will, it's like that ability to accept our choices, to be able to be willing to take accountability for them, and to stand in that. And that's almost a sense of empowerment, too. I mean, it's like having that... some kind of wiring that old saying, I can't remember who said it. Was it Truman that said the buck stops here? That whole type of thing. But in reality, as I see it, that's how truth is that I take accountability for my choices, whatever they are. And as far as thinking goes, I mean, yes, I may not agree with everything that my children, you know, what they think about or they come up with or the choices that they make. But the truth is I still love them regardless. And I also do my very best to not judge them. But, you know, as a parent, sometimes that's difficult too. I mean, it is because, you know, I go, you know, what the hell are you thinking? You know, I mean, it comes out.
Yeah. And that's because we're looking at it from our perspective, from our history, from
our story, our narrative.
Yeah, yeah. And which is not their narrative.
No.
Is it?
No. It's they may have pieces. Isn't. They may have threads of our narrative.
Correct.
But they have built their own one, taking our narrative and the parents and the step parents and their, you know, storyline and woven it together with friends and siblings, too, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which then, you know, thank goodness they get to create their own reality. Comes back down to respect. Okay, we're going to move on. Definitely going to move on. All right. Well, you and I have talked about this dynamic, I know, in the past. But, you know, when you think of the victim narrative and sort of the culture of, I call it the culture of victimology sometimes, that we see around as blaming... you know, or creating a scapegoat for why things are the way they are, you know, and not always looking at our part in it. How do you sort of feel that the victim story or the victim narrative, or some people, especially in my industry, use the term the victim stance. How do you sort of deal with that and within yourself and with the world around? You know, it's difficult to go, you know, turn on the TV and not hear a victim story pretty quickly these days.
Well, I've had lots of situations in my life where I could, where I have could feel like, you know, and play the victim. I mean, you know, divorce, failed businesses, failed relationships, you know, anxiety issues, phobia issues, stuff like that. Things that you can look at and you can blame away. You can make excuses why it shouldn't be something you have to deal with or have to handle. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. It doesn't change the fact that something is happening to you, something is going on, and you have to deal with it, period. And it's your issue. It may not have been your desire to have it be your issue, but it is now your issue, and you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So...
Well, because if not dealing with it, then it perpetuates the victim stance, and nothing ever changes. In fact, often it escalates.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't do... It doesn't do you any good to make an excuse or to, you know, blame away things that happen in your life just because you didn't affect it, because you're not the one that started it. You're not the one who, you know, did it, but it's affecting you. So to me, I always felt like, you know, I had to do what I thought the best thing to do was. And, you know, sometimes those things were right. Sometimes those things weren't right. And, you know, I made plenty of mistakes in my life, but, do I look back and think of myself as a victim when I look back on my life and I look back at all those things that happened to me? No, I don't feel like those things, you know, I could have been a victim, but I chose not to be a victim.
Yeah, yeah. So important. The learning to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, maybe that's not right. Learning to be okay with being uncomfortable also helps this out in life. Because, you know, one of the things that, that I notice, and especially... you know, working in the field I do, there's often a narrative that goes along that life is hard. And I'm not... one of the things that, that I work with a lot of clients and talk to, especially in group settings, is to begin to slightly shift that that conversation away from hard to maybe being uncomfortable. And instead of someone going, you know, this is so hard to do, and I say, is it really hard or is it just uncomfortable to do? So, like, about taking accountability and responsibility for identifying what my part in the problem is, I say, is it really hard to do that or is it just uncomfortable to do that? And most of the time, the answer will come back, well, it's just uncomfortable. I don't either want to talk about my part, you know, because it's uncomfortable to talk about it, or I feel bad about it, which I understand. And, or, you know, or it just, I don't want to look at, you know, my life in such a way that, you know, I'm ready to take responsibility for these things. And that's okay too, because it just may be, it may feel challenging in that moment. And it may be uncomfortable to do that in that moment. But I think at some point we all get down to it. At some point we get down to a place where we go, if I'm going to move forward in my life in a healthy way, if I'm going to have healthy boundaries, and if I'm going to be a respectful person, that I'm going to need to do the things that are uncomfortable. And I'm going to need to take accountability for doing those things and not expect it to be either given to me or someone make it easier for me or those kinds of things. That may happen along the way, you know. Definitely that's a possibility. But in the long run, it will come down to what my ability is to, you know, focus and function and accept responsibility for the choices I've made.
Yeah, I mean, I had a horrible fear of flying, you know, for my whole life. And
that must have been interesting going to Asia and the Pacific Rim and those areas. And
well, it started when I was a kid. Very early when I was young. I did not like to fly. I didn't like it. And you know, I would get sick and I would, you know, didn't like it at all. So not only
was headaches, it, nausea, you know, all that, I mean, the symptomology only, would come out.
Right. So not only was it hard, it uncomfortable, it was hard mm-hmm. too. So you can, it can be both. It can be uncomfortable uh-huh. and it can be hard. And so then you start to do things, you know, like avoidance, because you don't want to be in that uncomfortable place, right? Mm-hmm. So you start to figure out how you can avoid that. Mm-hmm. You know, well, what can I do so I don't have to fly? Okay. So, well, I'll drive instead, or I'll do this. And the next thing you know, I mean, and here I am, I'm involved in a business where you got to get on a damn plane. You know, these shows aren't in, you know, Provo. These buying shows are in, you know, New York, and they're in Chicago, and they're in, you know, Florida and South Carolina. And so you got to get on a plane and do that.
Sure.
And so, you know, sometimes, you know, you just have to just do it. As Nike says, you just have to do it. And, you know, for me, it's like sometimes I start to think, you know, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? What's the worst thing that can happen? You know, well, people can look at me and laugh and, you know, make fun of me or whatever it is they want to do and so forth. But, you know, I don't know these people. They don't know me. I'm never going to see them again. Uh-huh. So, I learned over, you know, over a long period of time to, you know, the more you expose yourself to uncomfortable situations, the more comfortable you can start to get in those situations.
Yes. Yeah.
And so over time, I started to figure out, you know, how to be in those situations. Now, I mean, is flying still something that I just love to do? No, it's mm-hmm. not something that I love to do, but it hasn't crippled me to where, you know, I flew to the Orient. I flew there, you know, two times every year. You know, those are 13,000, you know, those are 25,000 mile trips, you know, that you're flying on.
It's a long time. In a metal box.
You know, 14 hour flights from LA to Taipei, another 3.5 from Taipei to Bangkok. So, and you know what? Those are some of the things that I am the most proud of in my life.
Isn't fascinating? That's great. Yeah.
You know, overcoming those difficult obstacles uh-huh. is what makes you feel great.
Yeah. Yeah.
In your life.
Yeah. Learning to do difficult things or uncomfortable things.
Right.
And learning to find a way to go through that.
Right.
And putting this really comes down to developing strong beliefs that, you know, I can do these things. Yes, it may be uncomfortable. It may feel hard right now, but I can do these things. I can go through difficult times.
Yes. And one of the key things about that is loving yourself. Mm. You know, you have to, at some point in your life, love yourself. Because if you don't love yourself, it's real easy to just give up.
Yeah.
On that stuff,
yeah.
Right? So that's something that, you know, I had to try to figure out and learn and grasp. Gosh, probably not until I got into my mid-30s,
mm-hmm.
you know.
This idea of learning self-acceptance.
Yeah, self-acceptance.
And self-love.
Self-love, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, when you have these problems, you know, they're a lot bigger to you than they are to everybody else.
Yeah. Well, they're my problems.
Right.
That's right.
Because they're my problems.
Right. Yeah.
So that was something that I learned that, and it was an important thing to learn that one thing.
So, on learning, what would you say is one of the if there is you know, one or two important lessons in life that you've learned, do you remember what those are? You know, where you learned them, or who was involved in it, or just was?
Well,
you know,
I would say some of the important lessons I've learned is from my father.
Mm-hmm.
don't be afraid to try new things.
Yeah.
Don't think that everybody else is smarter than you are. You know, that was one of the first things he told me, or one of the, when I was in my mid-20s, and, you know, you're in business, and so you have attorneys that you work with, you have accountants that you work with, mm-hmm. you have bankers that you work with, and these are all people that are specialized in their fields. And so you look at them and you go, you know, wow, those guys, you know, they must be pretty smart, uh-huh. you know. And one day, you know, he came to me and he said, you know what? He said, don't think for a second that those people are any smarter than you are.
That's a good point.
It was a good lesson.
Yeah. Because, everyone has different issues and problems. And just because things look a certain way on the outside doesn't mean that, you know, that they, on the inside, everything's okay. And I deal with this a lot with clients that have worked towards finding sort of perfectionism in their lives and seeking to have everything look a certain way and present a certain way. But inside, there's so much turmoil and such a storm going on that you can't make everything clean enough and perfect enough and groomed enough to be okay when there's this big internal storm going on. And, you know, making a lot of money is not a reflection of being smart necessarily, but it is a reflection of, you know, commitment and dedication and discipline and those kinds of things.
Yeah, I was just
being able to make difficult choices.
Yes, yeah. And sacrifice.
Yeah.
Because being financially successful usually entails sacrificing, current happiness or consumption, which we're all told is happiness in our society, right?
Right.
Postponing that for some future benefit. And I sacrificed in my earlier years mm-hmm. and invested money that I could have used for nicer things in my life. But I learned that from my father. You know, he would always go out on dirt drives with my Uncle Klein, and I'd uh-huh. go with them once in a while, and they'd go look at property all the time on Sundays. Uh-huh. And once in a while, I'd go with them. So that kind of got into my blood, too. The investment thing got into my blood, and I learned how to invest my money. And that's probably worked out as well or better than my business. So...
Interesting. Yeah, I've gone with you on a few little drive-by to look at a few properties in the past. So I know you have a keen sense and enjoyment in that. I don't know if you have it anymore, but you sure did at one point. All right. What brings you the most upset or disruption in your life these days, if anything?
The most upset or disruption in my life, yeah. I would say it probably comes from... if there's something going on in the family with the kids mm-hmm. or like the health of my parents,
if
something's going on there, that's probably the thing that gives me the most mm-hmm. disruption or upsets me the most. Once in a while, it could be a political post on Facebook or something like that. But I've learned over the years, you know, to try to let that stuff go. And I think I'm doing a lot better at that than I used to, but those are the things that give me the most, disruption in my life is my, children or stepchildren, you know, having issues or my parents, you know, the health of my parents.
Yeah. I like that you went right to family on that, Alan. That I think is so indicative of where your values are. And it's easy to focus on other things. When I ask other people that question, it often does go to politics. You know, it's easy to do that. And then you and I recently, well, maybe it was last fall, I can't remember, last summer. It may have been last summer, I don't know. But this heart attack thing's been changed my memory slightly. No, it's me. It's aging. You know, on tyranny, The book, I remember I sent you a copy of it, and I thought about that, and I'm really glad I read the book, but I also realized that what it was doing was it was identifying a problem and the symptoms of those problems that I already knew was there. And it didn't start with the current administration. This has been going on for a while, and I've thought about this more recently, that when I think about what disrupts me the most is not necessarily the problems identifying through maybe some of the players or the political structures that are in place, but it's almost the apathy of the citizen that doesn't, you know, always take the problem seriously. And that's kind of been a different change. And so I've kind of looked at, you know, what's my part in this? What do I need to do differently? Okay, let's kind of switch right over to the other side. What brings you the most joy? What in life?
Well, I think what brings me the most joy is also what potentially brings me the most.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Yeah, I mean, it's watching your children do well. Mm-hmm. It's watching your, you know, having conversations with your parents. It's your relationship with your wife. You know, I think Wendy and I, since moving down here, our relationship is better.
And you don't mind. I mean, you partly moved here. We're in San Juan Capistrano, that area, right? So part of the reason why you moved down here from Utah was for health reasons as well. Yeah. And that has proved to be really beneficial from what it sounds like. I mean, spending the morning with you guys has been, you know, a really beautiful time together. But it feels like, you know, the health of the family is in a good place, you know.
Yeah. I mean, my wife is doing better, and our kids are all doing well. So that for me is a big part of it. Uh-huh. It's nice to go golfing once in a while. It's nice to go hit a bucket of balls. The weather's beautiful, you know. Take the dogs for a walk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've joined a couple of organizations down here to help, with some, the Boys and Girls Club and a couple of other things. So, you know, I still want to do that. I still think it's, you know, you hear the saying, you know, it's not about what you get, it's about what you give.
Yeah.
And I do think in the long run, that's probably a pretty accurate statement.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to give back to, you know, your society and to help other people, especially if you're in a position like me where you can do that. I'm blessed and fortunate that I'm able to help on some things. You know, I did some stuff with School of Rock.
Sure did. Yeah.
The foundation and stuff there. And that was, I love that. And I love that program. I still think it's a great program for kids.
It is amazing. It is amazing.
And I'm going to try to do more of that. That's kind of where my life is headed, is more in that direction. I'm still doing some construction projects. I'm building an office building in Salt Lake right now. That should be done in another 2 months. And I think after that, you know, it's probably time to just kind of wind that part of my life down. You know, there's a Buddhist saying that, you know, once the cup is full, you shouldn't keep pouring.
Which brings us to the next area.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, so how, you know, what are your beliefs? And I know you. This is one of the things you and I probably talked about almost the most, in some ways, is our spiritual beliefs and what brings us connection. You know, and it's not just one way. I know as we talk about this, but the idea of what brings you meaning and the sense of meaning in life, and you know about faith and God, and where do you find that, and what are your beliefs about that? You know, as far as
well, I always had a problem believing in the Christian Bible God,
mm-hmm.
the story of the Bibles. It was very difficult for me to accept those and believe them. And I believed in the fundamental tenets of Christianity, mm-hmm. the, you know, treat other people the sure. way you want to be treated, you know, help your fellow man, be nice to other people. And, but there was all this other stuff that was attached to it from an organized religion standpoint that I always just felt, didn't fit to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not saying that, you know, people who do believe that are bad or that they're wrong or that they're, you know, because I know a lot of Christian people, including my brother, who are very happy. They're very committed. They, you know, their religion brings them happiness and purpose and stuff. And that's the point.
Yes. Yeah.
That is the point of your religion is to find happiness within it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was when I went over to Thailand and, you know, one of the girls over there gave me this 45-page pamphlet on Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started reading it and I started going, wow. Wow. This is what I really believe.
You found something you synced up with.
Yeah, yes. I found yeah. something that resonated with yeah. me, and it was like, this is what I really, you know, for the most part, truly believe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's about the individual. It's about, you know, you finding happiness and meaning and purpose within yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the problems with attachment and suffering, you know, and what creates suffering and all those things. And I looked at that and I was like, wow, you know, this is a lot more along the lines of what I truly believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still believe it. I mean, I would encourage everyone, regardless of whether you're a Christian, a Muslim, atheist, it doesn't matter what you are. Yeah. I mean, The Art of Happiness by the Dalai Lama is one of the best books I've ever read, and it changed my life.
Yeah, that's a beautiful, it's a beautiful example of creating connection and purpose in life. The Art of Happiness, I believe.
Yeah,
you know, and taking ownership for that, finding yeah. that within ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're all works in progress, yeah. and you know, the one thing that I love about Buddhism is it talks. You know, it's you don't go to somebody and say, you know, I've sinned, please forgive me. It's, you know, you're responsible for yourself. Yeah. And, you know, yesterday is done. Yesterday is over.
Yep.
Focus on today.
Yeah.
Live in the present.
Yeah. And that equally not living in tomorrow either.
Yes.
Because that's where most anxiety and stress comes from.
Tomorrow doesn't exist yet.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So I told you in the beginning we were going to talk about the soundtrack for your life, Alan. If you were to have a song or two that you think is representative, or I've used also the term, if there was a life celebration for you, what would be the soundtrack there?
Oh man,
yeah,
that's a hard question.
Okay. Songs that have personal meaning or have been symbolic for you in some way of in your life.
Gosh. Well, Pink Floyd's probably my favorite group. So there would have to be a bunch of those songs from Pink Floyd in there.
Okay.
Time by Pink Floyd, I think, is a pretty good song.
So, the Dark Side of the Moon's got a number of just beautiful classics.
I would say, Money.
Yeah.
But I would say the song that I think of is probably Imagine by John Lennon.
By John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which really fits into that open, tolerant, accepting... I say even Buddhist mind.
Right.
Buddha mind.
Yeah.
Buddha mind.
Yeah.
About, you know, seeing the world with, you know, as one people, as one community.
Right.
As one
humanity.
Way of connecting. Yes, yeah. As humanity.
Yeah.
Yes, humankind.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the word humankind, by the way, a lot.
Right.
And I think Imagine's a beautiful representation of that.
I mean, I think if people just realized that we're all humans first and foremost,
yeah.
We're not, you know, Mormons, we're not Iranians, we're not, you know,
Jehovah's
Americans, French, German, we're human beings first and foremost, and that's probably the best message I think you could probably send would be that.
That's a beautiful message to go out on. Alan, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
Inviting me into your home and your hospitality. And we'll leave you today with, as we always do, with a little Joan Osborne. Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week.
What would